And counsel, just watch your clock if you want to reserve time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honor. And may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. There may be questions on how we are here and why the appellants are seeking relief from the dismissal order in 1 year bar to refiling. There are both personal and structural reasons for the appeal. On the personal side, the debtors are seeking to vindicate their rights and to correct the record. In a Chapter 13 case, debtors have an absolute right to voluntarily dismiss their case, subject to an exception provided in the statute dealing with conversion, which does not apply here. In this case, the debtors voluntarily dismissed their case before a scheduling order was expired for filing case commencement documents. The court, instead of the court honoring that dismissal order or the request for dismissal under 1307B, the court instead entered its own order 2 days later for willful violation of the...
What is the appropriate standard of review for us on these issues?
It would be, I believe, abuse of discretion.
And so I know one of the issues before the court is whether or not the bankruptcy court abused its discretion in imposing that 1 year refiling bar instead of the 180 days. Mm-hmm. Isn't there a for cause exception to that that would allow the bankruptcy court, if it found cause, to be able to go beyond the 180 days?
So our answer would be no. So there's a structural reason why we want this appeal, Your Honor. So 349A tells you what it doesn't do, right? It's a general presumption that a dismissal is without a bar to a discharge under the first clause and without a bar to refiling under the second clause. Our argument would be under the plain meaning of the textual structure of the statute and the punctuation that each clause should be treated independently and separate. So for the first clause, it has its own restrictive qualifier for cause unless the court orders otherwise. They can bar a discharge. We believe, based on the plain meaning of the statute, the second clause, which says, nor is a dismissal with prejudice to filing a subsequent petition, except as provided in 109G. And we think that except as provided in 109G is very express limiting language. We think it's the exclusive source and ceiling for a refiling bar under the statute based on how 349A is structured.
I guess your argument would have more force if the language, unless the court for cause orders otherwise, was maybe at the end of the first clause, then maybe you could make a better argument that the for cause only applies to the first clause, but actually starts at the beginning of the section, unless the court for cause orders otherwise, then boom, 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 first clause and second clause. So, I mean, it's a close call, but, you know, perhaps a better reading of it is that for cause applies to both the first clause and the second clause.
We think based on Law v. Siegel, the United Supreme Court decision in Law v. Siegel, that we can't rejected the principle that we can disregard the express language of the statute and kind of do a roving commission for equity to add inherent sanctioning power or equitable authority to punish misconduct. We think based on the semicolon as opposed to a period, and based on the two independent clauses and statutory construction of a semicolon treats two independent clauses. They're grammatically independent, maybe related. They're all dealing with what happens at dismissal. But each clause has its own sanction. Each clause has its own restriction on what can be prejudicial. Right?
Let's say that I generally agreed that bankruptcy courts are generally not allowed to impose a time bar that's greater than 180 days. Let's say that I generally agree. Are there any circumstances where bankruptcy judges can go over that? Are there any set of circumstances that you think are authorized to go over that?
So based on our reading of the statute, 109G would be the exclusive source.
So it would be a hard and fast rule that it's 180 days, that's it. You cannot, as a bankruptcy judge, go over that.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. But to add comfort, that wouldn't stop the court from punishing other misconduct that may arise based on similar facts. So, for example, it could be a 180-day bar, but the court has Rule 11 or 9011 sanctions, monetary sanctions. The court has criminal referrals it can do. It can dismiss a case, it can convert a case. For relief for stay, for example, of course.
Well, I think the court in this case was very concerned about the multiple filings, the dismissing, all of that. So I think there's a frustration, it sounds like. I don't know. I'm just reading the record from what I can tell.
We do dispute the facts, but be that as it may, our ruling would not require actually going into the facts. I think it's a clean rule of if it falls under 109G1 or 109G2, 180-day bar, plus whatever other conduct the court would like to, that it has authority to under the federal rules or under the bankruptcy code to punish.
So, I mean, one of the reasons under 109G1, for example, is the case was dismissed by the court for willful failure of the debtor to abide by orders of the court, which I know you're saying you can test some of the facts here, but that's one of the allegations is that the debtor was supposed to, you know, provide additional documentation and they failed to do so. So what's a court to do? What is the bankruptcy court to do to stop that kind of behavior?
So at least as to our case in particular, we have an absolute right to voluntarily dismiss our case. And the debtors did do that before the scheduling order expired. So we think you can't be in willful violation of a scheduling order that's supposed to move the case forward if you dismiss your case, as is your right to do. So you're kind of getting punished for exercising your voluntary right, your absolute right to dismiss a case. What is the court to do in this case is this is what Congress mandated, and we think the court should have to follow the strict mandates of the statute, even if it goes to places or even if it's uncomfortable. I think that's for Congress to clarify or to fix. But for these purposes, the court in this case, 109G2 would have applied because there was a relief from stay motion pending and the case was dismissed, so there would be an automatic 180-day bar. With that, if there aren't further questions, Your Honor, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Sarah Little, and I represent Milestone Financial, LLC. Whether the court erred by dismissing the case for failure to file schedules or not pursuant to the debtor's request for voluntary dismissal, the error was harmless in this case, and the court should uphold the court's decision. Whether it's dismissed for willful failure to file schedules or voluntary dismissal, these debtors particularly would be bound by 109G, either one or two.
Well, counsel, as my understanding is that your friend on the other side seems to say they have an absolute right to dismiss. They dismiss prior to the scheduling order. Isn't that a problem?
The court dismissed the case. So their absolute right to dismiss wasn't infringed. The cases considering this usually are comparing vis-a-vis a motion to convert to Chapter 7.
They did. You know, there's that whole one-year bar part that...
Right, but the one...
They would argue that. They were, in fact, prejudiced in that way.
The one-year bar was not a result of the dismissal for willful failure to file schedules in this particular case. It's a totality of the circumstances analysis, according to Levitt. And the court considered the history of filings by multiple family members. There was 13 filings within a five-year period here. And
you can tell from reading this record that someone was upset. In fact, that's why they issued maybe the one-year rule. It sounds like there were shenanigans happening.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's what the court considered. The one-year bar was not, it's pursuant to 349A, which every court other than the Tenth Circuit, and in fact, the lower courts in the Tenth Circuit are not particularly keen on the decision in Freehoff. They find the better reading is that unless the court for cause orders otherwise modifies both of the clauses in 349A.
Counsel, let me put you back, though. I want you to explain to me, because I'm not as well versed in bankruptcy. Chapter 13 cases, bankruptcy judge is allowed to dismiss him for failure to comply with the filing order, which is what happened here. But a person who, a petitioner or whatever, who filed their stuff can dismiss their case for voluntary dismissal as well, correct?
Correct.
So what's the difference? Why would one pick voluntary dismissal over the other?
Well, a debtor would pick voluntary dismissal to maybe escape the consequence of having a case dismissed for failure to file schedules.
What is the consequence?
That 109G one may apply to them for willful failure to abide by a court
order.
But then
is this harmless?
I believe it is harmless under these facts because the 109G2 prevents a person from filing for 180 days if they voluntarily dismiss the case while a motion for relief from stay was pending, which is also the case here. So whether the court dismissed based on its prior order to file schedules or it dismissed pursuant to the voluntary dismissal request by the debtors, they are still going to be bound by the restraints of 109G.
If we disagree with the bankruptcy court's finding that, and we say, no, look, they met everything that was required for a voluntary dismissal, a request by a debtor who has a Chapter 13 case that has not been converted. Mm-hmm. And we say, you know what, bankruptcy court, you got it wrong. It can be a voluntary dismissal. Can we also say, but bankruptcy court, you got it right with respect to the one-year refiling bar?
Yes. Because the analysis is totally separate for the 349. It's the Levitt factors of abuse of process here. And the findings were that there are, you know, 13 cases where nobody filed schedules, failed to prosecute, failed to show up for 341 meetings, two prior bars based on abusive filings in two of the cases. So that was what the court relied on in deciding the 349A issue.
And how do you respond to your friend on the other side's statutory construction argument with the semicolons and, you know, all of that?
I think virtually every other circuit disagrees with that. I think that it would have been a very simple matter for the court to construct that by making it two sentences if they did not want, unless the court for cause to modify that second part, put a period after the first one and then make it a whole new sentence, then we don't have any issue. But they didn't. And that whole statute starts every section with unless the court for cause orders otherwise. They want the bankruptcy court to be able to have discretion to police the abuse of process here. And not only is counsel's reading of it super narrow, but it would only allow a bar to refiling in the two circumstances set forth in 109G, which is not the complete, you know, menu of abusive practices that we deal with. That was brought in by creditors when they rewrote the law in 2005. They wanted to create an automatic ineligibility when a relief from stay motion was pending. The secured creditor lobbyists wanted to not have to continually file motions for relief from stay when a debtor dismisses and then refiles a case. So that's automatic. That's without discretion of the court. 349A leaves the court to decide any other issues of abuse.
What would have happened if instead of 1 year, the judge said 5 years? Would that still be okay?
That would still be okay. And in fact, the judge could order under the first part of 349A, which everybody is clear is unless the court orders otherwise, could bar this debtor from discharging any debts subject to this bankruptcy case. Now, the problem with this particular debtor is he listed no creditors. He listed no creditors in the matrix he filed. We don't know who he owes.
And I guess the safety from the debtor's perspective would be the good cause portion, that it would still have to be subject to the finding of good cause.
Yes. Yeah, okay. And in fact, in this case, with the one-year bar, the judge said, if the debtor can come to me and bring forth facts that would suggest that he needs bankruptcy for a new purpose that isn't abusive, I would consider that, I think, in a heartbeat. So the court is very concerned about the balancing of the rights of creditors to not be hampered by this sort of shenanigans, to use your word, versus the debtor's right to seek meaningful relief.
That's the official legal phrase.
I like it. I mean, the automatic stay in bankruptcy is an extraordinary exercise of federal power. For little more than cost of filing a petition, a debtor can immediately halt litigation, foreclosure, enforcement actions in virtually every other court without notice, without an evidentiary hearing or any preliminary showing of entitlement to that relief. So that is a hugely powerful thing that the automatic stay does. We have to be able to temper abusive behavior and limit a person's access if they're not going to use the bankruptcy court for its legitimate purpose, which is to reorganize and discharge debts. This debtor doesn't do that, or these both of them, they don't.
Well, suppose we say that the bankruptcy court erred in not granting the voluntary request to dismiss under 1307, but then we uphold the one-year bar under Section 349. As a practical matter, I mean, what does a bankruptcy court have to do? You know, sometimes we reverse and remand, and it requires the district court or the bankruptcy court to do a lot of things. I mean, what would be the practical thing that the bankruptcy court would have to do?
They would amend the dismissal order, saying it was based on the debtor's voluntary dismissal. I don't think anything else. And here again, it's harmless. 109G still applies.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you to pivot. You raised a possible mootness issue.
Yes.
Can you go ahead and address that, please?
I do think this is moot. The bar to refiling has already expired. I don't think that the repetitious capable of repetition yet evading review exception applies here. My friend argues that other debtors will be subject to a bar in greater than 180 days, but that is not what the standard is for that. It has to be this debtor and this controversy. I'm not sure I read that he indicated that he definitely will be filing bankruptcy in an abusive manner, but I think that that's a little bit of a twist on the issue here. It's a bit like the voluntary cessation problem, but kind of in reverse, where he's saying he absolutely will and he doesn't want to be subject to the longer sanction in a future, you know, problematic case. So I just think that the exception to mootness here shouldn't apply.
Okay.
And if the court has no other questions, then I will submit. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
In addressing the mootness argument, we do believe that the evades judicial review, but yet evades judicial review yet subject to repetition does apply here. So this court, these debtors were diligent in bringing this case to this court. As we know, with bankruptcy appeals, there's an intermediary level, either district court or BAP, before it goes to the Ninth Circuit. And these debtors from the BAP to full briefing did this in 10 months. So they did everything possible to get this before the court to get a ruling on these issues. Whether the court may use 349 and 109 to issue refiling bar greater than 180 days is an important issue. We think this court should provide clear guidance and consistent framework on the issue for all parties involved, whether it's debtors, creditors, and the court.
Let me ask you to address this, counsel. Is it a harmless error as to either calling it a voluntary dismissal or having the judge dismiss it?
No, it's not harmless. It should have been under 109G2, which is also 180 days. But the reason for the dismissal is critical. We don't want a refiling bar or a 109G1 willful disobedience or failure to prosecute to be used against the debtors in any litigation or case beforehand. No one wants that on their record, so to speak, to say that they didn't comply with a court order or they failed to prosecute. And we think it could have prejudicial effects on future cases and maybe negative credibility implications going forward. So we don't think that should be the case. I mean, what they were punished for, at least for the dismissal portion, was not complying with the scheduling order. And they weren't required to because they voluntarily dismissed their case, as there was their absolute right to do, and there were no exceptions that applied.
And then I'd like you to address your friend on the other side's argument regarding statutory construction and that if it wasn't meant to be read together, it would have had a period. It would have been two separate sentences.
I think we all could rewrite the statute much more clearly if we wanted to. The statute was amended. I believe there was a period before 1984 where the semicolon was. In 1984, the court, among many things, added 109G and 349A, I believe. Maybe it was 109F at the time, but it added the statutes to address serial filers. Fair enough. The serial filers, what Congress mandated or what Congress wanted was what was in 109G. So they didn't have to, the language in the second modifying clause, except as provided in 109G, isn't including as in 109G. That would involve no exceptions. It would be a list. Except as is very limiting, restrictive language. By adding that, Congress was saying, this is the only limitation we want for refiling bars. You still have all other avenues available before you under the federal rules and the bankruptcy code, and 105 to the extent it applies to sanction bad faith conduct. But as to this is the exclusive source and ceiling for a refiling bar. We also would say, at least on the statutory construction part as well, is our reading actually gives faith to the entirety of the statute. Because if 349A, excuse me, if 109G, the except as language, is just a minimum required or doesn't have to be followed, it kind of reads it out of the statute. I mean, what's the point of including it if for cause would apply to everything? The Congress could have written the statute much more clearly. But they were really targeting serial filers based on just 109G's 2 points. And I think the except as language was critical to telling the courts that this is the only thing you should be looking at. And for cause only applies to barring a discharge, which is a drastic remedy. Absent that, if there are any more questions, I'll submit, Your Honor.
Great. Thank you. Thank you both for the helpful argument. The case is submitted.